0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. 51551 is our text number. Maura MacDonald. Maura, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe. How are you doing?
What happened?
I just felt compelled to write in and let you know about something that happened to me when I went to have a mammogram.
Okay.
I went into a hospital and I was going into the check-in area to check in, see what would happen, what I'd do next. And I walked in, and it was a glass-walled room. And there was a man sitting on the first chair. There was only one person in the waiting room, and the man was sitting at the first chair as I walked in the door with his back to the other kind of waiting area outside. So basically on full view. And as I walked in, I couldn't help. Like, there was nowhere else I could see, but he was on his tablet. Now, this was an older man, and he was on his tablet looking at pornographic images as I walked in to check in for my mammogram. To say I was thrown and upset and very felt immediately, you know, you're walking through the door for something like a mammogram and you're kind of trying to gather yourself for what's coming up, and to see this was very upsetting. And then I had to take a ticket, and then I had to, you know, be in a room in a small space with this man. And I just thought, where am I even going to sit? Cause if he looks up, now he didn't even look up. He was so comfortable with what he was doing. Mm. He didn't even look up when I walked in. And I thought, I don't want to sit, because if he looks up from what he's looking at, he's going to be looking at me next.
Okay.
And I just felt so violated, very exposed. I just didn't even know where to stand, where to sit. And all I could think was, my instinct, anyone who knows me would know that I would, if that was somewhere else, a different space altogether, I would have said, come on, put that away. This is not the time or the place.
Yeah.
That's great. Now, I have to say, I'm not a prude. Whatever you want to do in the privacy of your own home, you know, go for it. Knock yourself out. But I just, all I was thinking was, this man was very obviously there waiting for somebody. He wasn't checking in himself. And I thought, if I say something, likely his wife is going to walk out and be upset because I'm there confronting him for looking at pornographic images.
And Maura, was that room, that waiting room in the hospital, specifically for people like yourself who were going in for a mammogram and their relatives or friends or whatever?
Well, as far as I know, it was, because that's where I was pointed to. I can't 100% say that. But there was only himself and myself in this small space. There was two women behind reception. And again, in that short space of time, I was thinking, those two women were in here alone with him looking at that. And then and I thought, if I say it to them, all I could think of, Joe, was it would be upsetting for them, as in what would they do, come out from behind their space and ask them to move. In the meantime, I didn't know. Somebody behind the other space could have been in a very sensitive, getting a diagnosis or gone in there.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
This was all running through my head in a short space of time. But what, just everything hit me. It was just the absolute, how he just felt so comfortable sitting there looking at it with his, you know, he was the picture of respectability there in his golf shirt and his broadsheet paper there beside him, but didn't even register the fact. He wasn't in a corner doing it in a private way. It was just like there could have been children walking outside, because he had his back to a glass wall so everyone could see what he was looking at.
Doesn't dilute the awfulness. Did he make any attempt even to move the iPad
he continued what he was doing. He was moving the screen along. It was like he was perusing what was there. He continued to watch it. To look at it, it was still images. Well, as far as I saw, I don't know what he moved on to after that. So I just, and then after that, and this is just how it is, but again, it is a bugbear of mine as well. Then I called up, my ticket was called. And then, in this quiet space where I feel very vulnerable, very exposed, you're asked over the counter for your personal details.
Yeah.
So I was trying to whisper them, because I thought, I already felt, as I said, very exposed being in the situation with this man. And then I was given my name, my date of birth, my insurance number, address. It just, the whole thing. And then
you have
after
to,
that,
sorry, you're
I
right, Maura.
And have a mammogram.
Yeah, but you have to speak those details, and the person on the other side of the counter has to hear them. So there's every possibility that this man sitting close by watching porn would hear your first name, your second name, your DOB, or whatever.
They were all of it, yeah. So I was just, it was very upsetting, and it just, but then I still had to go and have my mammogram, which anyone know, it's fantastic that we can have them, and everyone, like all women, we should have them. But it's not the most pleasant of experience. You're left feeling very vulnerable, very exposed in that. So I had to then go up to that after just going through what had happened in this waiting room. And I was absolutely furious and upset. And it was, for want of a phrase that I know is used a word, I did feel very triggered. Even for the rest of the day, I was out for my usual walk, as I do, kind of walking around, my headphones on, listening to a book or listening to music or whatever. And I just, all of the usual, I walk around a park. Normally, I let it slip, but, and again, it was in a conversation with a male friend of mine saying, has this ever, like, most women, I think, will relate to this in their whole lifetime. You walk along the place and you're being told, smile, oh, cheer up, love. Whereas I don't know any man, any one of us, has anyone ever told a man to smile or cheer up? But just that women, this kind of objectification of women who are there.
Well, the last incident of this nature, I remember on Liveline, is about 18 months ago, and a woman was on a train. And he was sitting beside her on the train with a table in front of them. And he proceeds to start watching porn in full view. He knew she could see.
Yeah.
It was unavoidable. Maury, you think there should be signs? There are signs up in waiting rooms, wash your hands and no mobile phones or whatever.
Exactly.
Do you think there should be, please do not watch inappropriate?
Yes, that's what I came away thinking. Really, have we got this far? And like I said, and not that I'm in any way, I have a young son, like a teenage son and two teenage daughters. And we can't blame young people. This was an older man who should have known much better. But at least I was trying to see all the scenarios in my head. And I thought, even if there was a sign, I could have pointed to it without having to say anything.
Of course.
I think that says you cannot, there can be no inappropriate viewing in a safe space.
Yeah.
There should, you know, but he didn't even look up. So yes, my question is, do we need to have signs now? Are people that, just because all this stuff is accessible, like just because we can,
yeah,
doesn't mean
so
we
accessible, yeah, so accessible. And iPads now, there's mini iPads, mini tablets. That. You can carry them in your hand, and they're not much bigger than a. So Maura, to come back on one of your points, why didn't you? And this should not be the tone of this question, by the way. Why didn't you check him? Why didn't you say to him, stop?
My initial instinct was thinking he is here likely waiting for a woman.
Okay, so you had his more wife. Consideration for him and his wife than he had for you.
I just thought if I'm in a, you know, in a confrontation, not even confrontation, and she walked out. But I was also aware I didn't know what was behind where you go in. So I thought anyone could be in there, like I said, getting a diagnosis, having an exam in a very fragile state. But this was all, it happened in minutes, but that's what ran through my head. And I thought this, and I was also aware I had to look, I was going for an exam, and I'd be more worked up than I was if I was having a set to with this, this older man sitting there. And like I said, he was as comfortable. And it's just kind of, you know, the question that begs the question of this kind of air of privilege and entitlement, that he was just okay to be sitting in there of an afternoon or a morning.
So is there a wider problem here with the increase in these tablets and screens everywhere? Like, I see one truck driver saying, 51551, by the way, is the text number. One truck driver saying, I'm sitting in traffic on the M50 and I look down from my cab, which you can, of course, and there was a driver with his laptop in the stopped car, I hope it was stopped, watching porn.
Yeah. It is, I think, it's definitely a wider issue as to what is the conversation with female and male friends over the weekend about this, going, was that his kicks? Was he getting his kicks because he was doing it in a public place? I don't know, nor do I want to know, you know, but it's that surely people should know better than to be able to honour a private space. I know it is a public space, but you know what I mean? Somewhere where you're going to have a medical waiting room, a medical, you know, for a checkup, whatever. But you should know that you can go in there and feel that you're safe and you're able to gather your thoughts and get yourself ready for whatever it is you're going in for. You know, whereas now I feel, is there no safe space, particularly for women? Is there no safe? So I have two teenage daughters, and
well,
and
answer the rhetorical, Maura. Is there safe space? Do you think? Is it getting much worse?
No, I don't think there is. No, okay. I think that's what I'm saying. Even when I'm out for my walk, and you know, you've been walking around, and you get comments, and I'm sure if I was to put, I was only telling you to smile or do the next lap faster or whatever. But what I don't know, again, the male friends that I spoke to about, no, that's never happened. I've never been told to smile. I've never been commented on when I'm walking around or my physical appearance or, you know, all that kind of. So it's just, and now we're taking it to another level with, I suppose, the point I'm making, whether I'm making it well, is that, as I said, that man was looking at those images, and when he looked up, I was going to be in front of him. So how was I being objectified? What was he putting on to me?
I just wonder if you asked public, private waiting rooms, offices, or where the public gather, if you asked them to put up a sign saying, okay, please wash your hands, that's fine. Please put your mobile phone on silent, that's understandable. And then if you added, please desist from watching inappropriate images, would people then think, oh my God, there's something going on in this room, there's an issue?
It is. It's not like, but all in the short space of time where all the scenarios ran through my head, I thought, I'm just going to make, if I went to the, I didn't want to seem accusative to the two women behind reception asking them to deal with it. I was aware he was probably waiting for somebody, and I was, you know, thinking it was an older woman that she'd be coming out. Who knows? I just didn't want to put her through that. Okay. But yes, I don't know. Should there be, I get your point. Maybe people will be thinking something has gone on there, and is it a safe space? But like, I was shocked. I'm no, you know, I've
Annie,
been around.
Annie,
the block.
There's no simple solutions, but Annie, your sign is one of them.
But you, at least, you know, it could be pointed to by either a member of staff or the person who.
Well, the other solutions for another aid is for you to, as you've done, thankfully, raise it here, and people might be more cognizant.
As I said in my email, it was the straw that broke the camel's back. You know, it was just enough is enough. Maybe it's with, you know, two teenage daughters coming up. I thought,
Would you say it to your daughters?
Yes, I will. I'll be having a conversation with my son and daughters. Yeah, and I know friends have had the conversation with their children as well. So yes, I think maybe it is a conversation to be had with men and boys of all ages. I can't stress enough, this man was an older man.
Okay, when you say older, in the world we live in, older now is 104.
Yeah, will I say what age I think he was? I think he was in his 70s.
Okay, that's fine.
Yeah.
Okay, Maura, thanks indeed. Yep. By the way, more importantly, thanks for raising that point, but also the issue. I hope the mammogram went
as best. Hopefully it will. Okay. Yeah.
Maura, just hang on for a sec, Maura. I need to take a break. I'll be back after this break.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe at RT.ie. Maura was in a hospital, a private hospital in Dublin last week, in a waiting room for her mammogram appointment, and she walked in. One of the person in the room, he was a man in his 70s, and with a tablet, not on his iPhone, that wouldn't have been acceptable either, but with a tablet, not a medicinal tablet, I hasten to add, is an electronic tablet. He was watching pornographic material in full view of Maura and made no effort to desist or stop or indeed divert him the laptop from Maura's eyeline. Josephine, good afternoon. You're a nurse.
Hi, good afternoon, you're a nurse in
a hospital. What could, what should, what would Maura have tried to do?
Well, I think it would have been very helpful in the situation to notify staff, whether it was staff at the reception when she was checking in, or when this lady had gone inside to a different room for her mammogram, to let the staff know what she had been exposed to. Yeah. And staff would have called security and security could have come up to deal with the situation.
Have you ever come across such a situation in your hospital, Josephine?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And what was the procedure?
We, as a staff member, would just inform the person who was inappropriate behaviour, and they would stop.
You'd ask them to turn off the laptop or leave?
We would just tell them it was unacceptable behaviour. Okay. And they would turn it off, yeah.
But the issue is you called security?
Well, that's what we would do. If we felt that we didn't want to say it ourselves, mm-hmm. we would call security for backup.
Okay, Maura, were you...
In the event.
Okay, Maura, was
officer,
that...
Officer.
Yeah, I'm not...
Go ahead, John.
Maura, is that any help?
It's putting the onus on me to deal with it, and I'm not saying that even the onus is on mm-hmm. somebody in the staff. I'm just, at the time, I just wanted to get out my mammogram, and it wasn't you know, I had more time to think of it that I thought how absolutely, even though it threw me and I was very upset at the time, it was afterwards the more I thought about it. But the point being, the responsibility, in other words, the onus still lies on this man, this absolute appalling behaviour of this man thinking it was okay to look at pornographic images. So why, when I'm in, you know, like I said, a mammogram, it's not a piece of cake. You know, I'm not in there. I had that to get through, and I didn't want to go and find somebody to deal with this man who was doing what he was doing.
John is in Dundalk, joe@rt.ie. John, what happened? It was on a train.
It was on a train journey. There was four youngish, probably young to middle-aged men.
Okay.
And they were looking at what I, without going, obviously going into detail, a cross between extreme stroke violence of what that lady is talking about and passing the phone between them.
Good God.
I've also seen...
Just on that episode with that quartet on the train, were the four of them sitting together in...
Yeah, I was behind them and I'm a bit of a hothead and I had trouble stopping myself from challenging them on it.
Why? I'm not encouraging it, but yet why did you? How did you manage to stop yourself?
Well, the other thing about me, Joe, is I'm a bit of a coward, and there's four of them, and they're fairly big.
Okay.
And basically, previous to that, now that this has come up, you think about this sort of thing. I saw he can only have been about 12, simulating copulation, a boy looking at his phone. Somewhere in North Dublin. Just on a more general point, then I leave you in peace. Justin, I think the emphasis on parents having to manage that is true, but there's much greater responsibility on the service providers and the... I mean, they know the location where that person is in. They know they're not at home. They could cut that service out if they wanted to.
But how would
at
you?
At that point, in
yeah,
time.
But yeah, but the child could be watching a maths project on the when he's not at home. How do you determine the, how? Would, apart from just banning all.
If the service providers don't know it, the site knows it.
But those sites, those porn sites, they're for money, aren't they? They're monetizing. They're making money through ads or whatever else they do.
Yeah, but that's a matter of regulation and legislation.
But as a
general point, Joe, there should be much more emphasis on the original providers. And by the way, I've read a bit up on this via the Financial Times, and actually, most porn sites are managed indirectly by the Visa card companies. Now, I'm not making that up. What they can provide and what they can provide, and if you want, someone wants to ring me afterwards, I'll point them to where the Financial Times did a very detailed series on this. And effectively, the censors of porn sites are the Visa, are they the credit card companies?
I was totally unaware of that. Okay. Okay, John, thanks indeed. That's John and Mara McDonald. Joe at rt.ie, 51551 is the text number. Just a reminder, the two events next week, one, the 60th anniversary of the JFK visit to Ireland. Now, you'll hear a lot about it between now and then, but being Liveline, what we want to hear on next Wednesday week, which is the 60th, is the ordinary people of Ireland, obviously 60 years ago, so we're moving on in terms of generations. Might be one of the last few times we can mark a decade commemoration of the JFK visit. Were you there? Were you involved? Did you meet someone that day that you've never left your side? Were you involved? I know we're trying to find the cadets who were involved, Gardaí who were involved on the JFK trip in 1963. I was a 5 or 6 year old, I can't remember, 63. I stood in Parliament Street in Dublin, I remember vividly, with my father and my three brothers. My mother was at home having a baby girl, so to speak, Pauline. Happy birthday, Pauline. Now everyone knows. And we were standing in Parliament Street. I was completely mesmerised by the crowds. I was completely mesmerised by the RT trucks and vans and cameras. I remember a Comer van. And then we waited with bated breath as the cavalcade. Now, you cannot imagine the crowd. There's never been a crowd like it. As the cavalcade came up, went down Airport, O'Connor Street, Dame Street, 6, 7, 10 deep, and you see the cavalcade, the magnificent Secret Service cars and the outriders, the Garda outriders, the army in front, the army motorcycle corps in front. Eamon de Valera sitting in the car. John F. Kennedy, as he came around onto Parliament Street, past Sloan's, all I could see was his incredible suntan. This man in a casual suit with a shirt and tie, by the way. And he also had he wore a trilby, but that wasn't on him. Eamon de Valera, much older, sitting back wearing an overcoat, I think. And the suntan and the blue eyes of JFK. And of course, he waved at me personally, because everyone who was out for those 3 days believes that JFK did wave at them personally. And then he went on up to Orison Uachtaráin, which we'll be talking about in a few minutes. He went on up to Orison Uachtaráin, and there was mayhem, and the elite of Dublin made a holy show of themselves, famously memorialised by the great Patrick Kavanagh. So if you had any hand, act, or part, good, bad, or indifferent, in the JFK visit 60 years ago, you know Liveline is the place to tell your story. Joe at rt.ie. And then on the Friday, the last weekend of June the 30th, we will be in the Titanic in Belfast with all the usual performers, Frank Ford, Al Forn, Packy. Regards our wonderful Frank Toomey, unfortunately, is in hospital at the minute. Kind regards to Frank. You all know him from Funny Friday for his Mary O'Rourke, for his Healy Rays, for his Mossy stories. And those of us who were young at JFK and beyond will remember Frank Toomey as Bosco. He's in hospital, and hopefully he will be home soon. He's in Cork University Hospital. That's the great legendary Frank. Two events next week. Joe at rt.ie. Titanic, come along before one. It's a big room. Tom Carew. Tom, good afternoon. Now, between the time that I mentioned your call and another call I have here about what President Michael Lee Higgins said in the Sunday Business Post yesterday about this woman who I'm told very few people have heard of, which is surprising. But anyway, and he said this is the new forum on international relations, basically on neutrality, set up by the government. It starts this Thursday, Friday, I think 2 days next week, Dublin, Cork, Galway, and I think Dublin again. And they are open to the public, but as usual, you have to register. And I just looked up the website this morning, and anonymously, the sign at the bottom said sold out. I'm sure some people will get a giggle out of that. Anyway, this is what the president said about the chairperson of the forum, not the organiser of the forum, but the person who's in charge of it. He said, and the person who's in charge of this has a very large DBE, Dame of the British Empire. I think it's grand, but you know, I think there were a few candidates I could have come up with myself. Now, led off by Charlie Flanagan, former Minister, former Minister for Justice, he thought this was a gratuitous attack on Louise Richardson, who, by the way, is from Ring in County Waterford, went to the Ursuline Convent, then went to Trinity College. She was chairperson of the anti-apartheid group in Trinity College. I think I have a vague memory, because I was in Trinity at the time, that she actually went to South Africa with the Dunstores strikers.
That's true.
Who's that, Tom?
Yes, Tom.
Yeah, you come in, you tell me. I'm sick of talking. Go on, people are sick of listening to me. You tell the story.
Yeah, well, by the way, when Maura was on, she used three very striking words: privilege, entitlement, and violation. And they struck me that the present discussion on what the President said, those three words, privilege, entitlement, and violation, come into it. The language he used was simply hysterical, talking about, you know, playing with fire. He was personally abusive to Louise Richardson. Now, she was born in Waterford, schooled in Waterford. She came from a very ordinary family. The father worked in ESSO. She got to Trinity. She ended up in Harvard. And she was
Her father worked where?
For ESSO. He was a Dublin came to Tramore. He met her mother, who was a Tramore woman. He met her in Tramore. Okay. And he worked there. So she didn't come from a silver spoon background. The president didn't only got it half right. Not only in Oxford, before that she was head of Aberdeen University, and she started off there with huge access program, which greatly boosted the number of students coming from very deprived backgrounds. And then she continued that in Oxford. I mean, great work is done in Trinity and that as well. Mm. But he didn't even manage to mention her work in Aberdeen when he mentioned in his apology today about her doing that in Oxford. But when I said violation, Article 7 of the Constitution could not be more clear. It says the President may, after consultation with the Council of State, communicate with the Oireachtas or address a message to the nation on a matter of national or public importance, but only with the approval of the government. Now, there's no indication he consulted the Council of State, but even if he did, he certainly obviously did not do it with the approval of the government. That's a straightforward, unambiguous violation of Article 7 of the Constitution.
Now, I want to, now, in fairness, given that we're talking about Louise, it is Louise Richardson, and a lot of people, as I'm told, would not have. But this is the between me mentioning it at 12:30 to the other Louise Duffy, and 1 o'clock. No connection, of course. The president issued an apology, according to Brian Dobson, and he said it was a throwaway remark. He said he was remarking about her very large on the forum, which you can look at on the website, on the program for the 4 days. Every time she is referred to, she has a very large letter DBE. But that's because she's a dame of the British Empire, which I think so is Edna O'Brien, Bob Geldof, I think he's a KBE, I think Bono is an honour, Sally Mulready, Irish woman campaigning in Britain, and by the way, much championed in fairness by Uachtaráin na hÉireann. She's an OBE, Sir Anthony O'Reilly. As an OBE, and Sir Anthony O'Reilly is obviously speaks to Harry Crosby, I think, as an MBE. So I don't know whether it's an issue with Irish people accepting honours. But as you know, Tom, for an Irish citizen, which Louise Richardson is, if she had to ask the Irish government, was it okay to be accepted DBE, because she got it not just for a disadvantage, but she got it because Oxford, when she was in charge of Oxford, which was during the pandemic, Oxford, and we'll all remember the name Tess Lamb, the Irish scientist, working in Oxford, they were at the forefront of developing a vaccine.
Oh, yeah.
And also, one of the stipulations is, and I suspect Louise is very proud of that, especially given her background, her campaigning years, that the vaccine that Oxford worked on would be available at cost to especially the third world countries, that it would be, that wouldn't be monetized in such a big way. But anyway, the president said he didn't. It was a throwaway remark. Do you accept his apology?
I made throwaway remarks in the pub watching the Ireland Greece match the other night, Joe, and you know, I think a lot of people might have. But presidents don't exist to make throwaway remarks. And the idea that somebody of his age and experience and of his office can, you know, say, I just made a throwaway remark, that itself is an abuse of office to make throwaway remarks. But it's a constitutional abuse, because he needs the approval of the Council of State, but also the approval of the government to address any message to the nation.
Okay, Louise Richardson.
In Article 7.
Okay, Louisa, I'll come back to that in a second. Louisa Richardson has been in Orison Rook, Ron, and this is, she was invited there by the former president, President Mary McAleese. And this is President Mary McAleese speaking in the Oris about Louisa Richardson.
Today we're going to hear from Dr. Louisa Richardson on the theme of Ireland's role in the world. Louisa's own life and her very distinguished academic career has prepared her very well to take us through this theme. Several decades ago, Ireland made a fundamental decision that our place was out there in the world rather than turned in on ourselves. And we've managed to carve a fairly unique place for ourselves in the world today. And I know that I look forward with huge interest to hearing what Louise has to say about that role and about our possibilities.
And this is another short extract from that. They were broadcast on RTE, by the way, these presidential lectures. I know, because I chaired them in the hours, and I met Louise and the other speakers over the week. This is a short extract from what Louisa Richardson, who's at the centre of this storm at the minute. Some people saying now that her position, her position has been made untenable by what the president said. But this is Louise talking about political violence.
My academic work has actually been focused on international relations and political violence. And my preoccupation with both derived directly from my Irish roots. On the other hand, my interest in political violence, and especially in those who perpetrate it, was driven by a sense that academics who studied terrorism in particular didn't understand the forces that drive people to violence to effect political change. The literature on terrorism has depicted terrorists as one-dimensional bad guys and psychopaths. My reading of Irish history, and indeed of my own times in Northern Ireland, suggests that it is much more complex than that. And I have been completely fascinated by how people who are responsible parents, students, teachers on the one hand, and can at the same time carry out brutal acts of violence, by the ways that they can justify these actions both to themselves and to others.
And the plus Louisa Richardson, the president also said, Tom, I think it's grand, but you know, I think there are a few candidates I could have come up with myself. The implication there is that there are a few better candidates I could have come up with myself than Louisa Richardson.
Well, an interesting thing about Louisa Richardson, she was a 14-year-old schoolgirl in Waterford in 1972 when Bloody Sunday happened, and she was so outraged, her mother had to lock her in a room. She wanted to go to Newry to the mass protest after it. Now, I remember marching on the British Embassy at that stage, and there was huge emotion and feeling and so on the issue. So she's somebody who has obviously thought a good deal about violence and has come to a mature and balanced understanding.
But Tom, in this particular case, because it's very unusual for the president, a president, to actually...
unprecedented.
Well, it's unprecedented for the president to make an apology in this sense as well. But for the... But do Irish people have a problem with DBE, Dame of the British Empire, or Sir Bob Geldof, or the Edna O'Brien DBE? Do people, or Marianne Griffiths, another incredible figure in the National Health Service, Irish DBE,
do we have a problem? I mean, to me, it's about as ridiculous having a problem as saying Irish people shouldn't be playing for Man United, for example. I mean, the recent programme, the documentary on RTÉ.
Okay, I don't know whether you heard of Anna Bacik on the 1 o'clock news, but she, of course, as expected, she stood up for Michael D. Straight to the mast for Michael D. Locked hard on it, but she had a problem with DBE. This is her reference.
Listen
to this for a sec, Tom.
I do think the optics of having a chair with a, and I should say I have the utmost respect for Professor Louisa Richardson, and indeed the President's remarks in no way impugned her. What he may have been referring to, and he's clarified today, is the DBE and the state. And, you know, I do think there's a valid concern about the optics of having someone chair a consultative forum who has, you know, with a title of that sort. And I think that itself requires...
Why?
Well, may I say, it requires, therefore, that the participants in the forum would be clearly drawn from all perspectives of neutrality. And I think Cathal Berry himself...
Are you saying that she's not neutral in your view?
I think she is neutral.
But Ivana Bacik, leader of the Labour Party, of which Michael Lee was and President Michael Lee Higgins was a former senior member for many, many decades and often its most prominent member, said, hang on, just address this, Tom. I don't want any... she said the optics of DBE are wrong and it is a valid concern.
Well, that's sort of naked bigotry. I'm really shocked.
No, it's not, Nate. It's not. You cannot accuse, of all people, Ivana, of that. But anyway...
No, I'm saying this is inconsistent with everything I've ever heard Ivana saying. I mean, Irish men have made a huge contribution in Man United, for example. And Irish men have played different codes with distinction. So the idea that an Irish woman who makes a distinguished contribution in Aberdeen, in Scotland, and then in England and Oxford, and particularly in Excess, and who also, whose record includes going to South Africa with the Dunstore Strikers, to say that somebody like her, who's recognised by any other country, be it France, be it Britain, be it the US, be it Ireland, whatever, that should be held in many ways a black mark, to me, is absolutely off the wall and really out of date in this day and age.
The former Irish ambassador, and indeed to the UK, and indeed to the USA, Daniel Mahal, a well-known author as well, he said the remarks were regrettable. Ruth Dudley Edwards, a historian, she said she spoke of the arrogance of the president. Who is it? Charles Flanagan, former, said it was a gratuitous attack. Kieran Matches, Joe at RT.ie. You don't know Louise Richardson either, but let's hear her voice again from that same speech. Ironically, given in Ars Neutron. Here she is, and she's talking about peacekeeping.
The historical Irish tradition of involvement overseas is extraordinary for a country of this size. From the ancient travelling saints and scholars dispensing Christianity and knowledge around Europe, to the 800 Irish soldiers serving in UN peacekeeping missions in 12 different conflict zones today. And I hope we will never forget the 85 Irish soldiers who have given their lives while serving as peacekeepers. I cannot think of another country of this size that can lay claim to such an international reach.
That is Louise Richardson. Kieran Matches, Kieran, yes. You say you don't know. Well, a lot of people don't because a lot
of
her...
I don't know. I have never heard of her until now.
But she was forced. She broke many a glass ceiling. And she's still a very mm-hmm. she's still a very young woman, by the way. She wrote many a glass ceiling. Yeah, go ahead, Kieran.
Listening to your previous call, there's very little more I can say. My point is that he's president, and he shouldn't use it for his own personal program. Oh, not program. Sorry, views.
Well, do you think he should have criticised the chairperson of it?
No, it's not. It's not who you think should be there, or him, for instance.
Do you think the chairperson can continue after the first citizen of the country? It's a state appointment.
Yeah,
the first citizen of the country said, "I could think of a few candidates myself."
Yeah,
and she has a large DBE before her name.
DBE,
Dame of the British Empire.
ASS. But she should, yes, because it wasn't. It's not a government. It's not a government opinion. So it's not. He's speaking as a private citizen. Obviously.
Okay.
And he has no clout as private citizen. And the only reason I think he did it is he can't be re-elected because he's had his second term. So he can throw a few cats among pigeons.
Well, one thing I looked at this last week, the programme for the 4 days. And in fairness to, now, Uachtaráin wasn't making this point, but in fairness, if you look at it, I think the Taoiseach, Micheál Martin, I think he addresses it twice. Then we have the Taoiseach, obviously, he addresses it when it's in Dublin. And then we have the leader of the Green Party, he addresses it as well. So the three of them are getting an outing. Why wouldn't they let the President open it? Given his views on neutrality, why maybe he was upset about that he wasn't asked to give a in Dublin Castle.
Then, but yeah, it doesn't matter. He should keep his trap shut when he's not speaking for the country.
But it's unusual because Michael, as I mentioned earlier on, is championing of Sally Mulready and for a work with immigrants. Mm-hmm. Irish immigrants in the UK, but she also, that's Sadi Reedy, MBE, OBE now, but she's also a member of the Council of State, appointed by Michael D. Higgins.
What do you think,
Kieran, of the President's apology that it was a throwaway? He doesn't address this thing.
It wasn't an apology.
But he doesn't address the point. I think there were a few candidates that come up with myself.
No, say something just to get them off my back.
Okay, where's... You know? Okay, Brian Gould. Brian, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. How are we?
Good. What do you think of the apology for referring to the large DBE type?
Well, I think what Michael D... I mean, I wouldn't agree with Michael D. Higgins and everything, but I agree with him and this got her into the front. I mean, it's about neutrality, and Ireland is supposed to be a neutral country. And we have Micheál Martin saying like that, well, military neutral.
Okay, I'm not.
But politically.
Okay, that'll be debated from 7 o'clock in the morning till 11 o'clock at night here on other programmes in RT at the moment. But what we're focusing on today is the calls we got about this remark about Louise. That's why I devoted so much time at 12:30 when I was mentioning what was coming on the programme to these calls, saying they were upset about the reference to the chairperson being on our large DBE. And this, you heard Ivana Bacik there saying it is the optics are not good with the DBE and there are valid concerns, which is for a leader of a political... So now we have the president and the leader of the Labour Party, it seems, both worried about the fact that the chairperson of this forum has DBE. And if Louise Richardson had refused to accept the DBE for her work on disadvantage, and I think more importantly at the time for her work on developing the vaccine and democratising the vaccine, if she hadn't accepted her DBE, there wouldn't be a problem. Isn't that right?
Yeah, but I mean, I never heard of Louise Mary Richardson until last night, this morning kind of a thing.
Okay, yeah.
But I mean, her chairing this, I mean, it's inbuilt with people who are aligned to NATO and PESCO and other military alliances, and she is facilitating this, that these people will be able to talk about her.
Yeah, but she
would be chairing, she would be facilitating.
She was asked,
like you said at the start of the programme, I can't even get a ticket to it, or anybody of my ilk can't get a ticket to it.
Okay,
it's all for people. This is the whole thing. The government are saying like that it's an open forum. Mm-hmm. It's not an open forum. I mean, it's inbuilt with people who are aligned to NATO or PESCO or other
organisations.
And she's in front of it.
Yeah.
And
okay,
Michael D. Higgins was giving the views, I think, of many people in Ireland that this is...
To come back to Louise Richardson, because this is the woman that's being maligned. She is chairing it. She did not pick the venues. She did not pick the speakers. She should not work out the agenda. She is chairing it. And then the different sessions are chaired by different individuals, most of whom, it seems, are from the Irish Times. But that's another thing. And that's more than understandable. She did not pick the speakers, and looks to me like no matter what happens, the people who, and as is their right, and they've been coming out in support of Michael D this morning, the people who believe that we should stay neutral forever and ever and ever, which is a legitimate point of view, and it seems supported by the majority in the country, they won't take any heed of this because they believe, like you, that it's loaded.
It is loaded. Yeah. I mean, she knew when she was appointed to chair this. She knew the speakers.
Did she? How do you know that, Brian?
Well, I mean, if you're asked to chair a meeting, you would be asking who's going to be the speakers of this meeting. And she knew who the speakers were. And if she didn't know, should have known.
Yeah, well,
and she
like,
could also have
yeah,
said,
but there is,
you, no, I'm
like,
not chairing
you, you,
it.
You made the point about NATO and all that kind of... Cathal Berry, the TD, who knows a lot more about this than any of us do, I suspect, he said it was unfair. For example, Michael D said there was admirals and Air Force. There isn't. There's no admirals and there's no members of any Air Force there. And there was generals. There are five generals. They're all Irish generals. Three of them are retired. And what's the Irish Army, as Louise Richardson pointed out, what is the, and indeed Ivana Bacik pointed out today, what is the Irish Army best known for in the world? For our peacekeeping. This is the last clip of Louise Richardson speaking in Ars Neutron.
I think that this near universal goodwill towards Ireland is a unique and powerful basis on which to build a place for Ireland in the world going forward. This goodwill has been acquired because of the hard work and enormous contributions made by the generations that have gone before us. But if we want to sustain this feeling, every generation will have to contribute. We cannot casually assume that we will always be liked or admired overseas.
That is Louise Richardson, who is now will be the subject of many a profile in next Sunday's newspapers. We'll be back. Thank you, Brian. Thank you, Tom. And thank you, Ciarán. I'm back after this break. Joe at rt.ie.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe with RT last week. You may have heard last week, it was a pretty hard-hitting report from Ger Deering. Ger used to be the taxi regulator, I think before then he was a county manager in Carlow. He's been around a long time. He's still a young man. He's been around a long time, but he's the Ombudsman for the Public Services, and he raised an issue which has been raised on this programme and others, in fairness, over the years, and that is, we all believed, I think, that somebody with a severe disability could get a grant, a significant grant, to get their car adopted, or adapted, proper word, adapted for, you know, whatever challenges you had in terms of your arms, your legs, or whatever. And but he pointed out, since 2013, a full 10 years ago, that programme has been closed. You cannot apply. It was a means tested payment. But now, Pat Rowe, let's put human faces on these awful challenges. Pat, good afternoon.
Hello, Joe.
Good. How are you? Tell us about Anna Rose.
Good. Well, it's not Anna Rose. It's Katie Lynn.
Oh, Katie Lynn. Sorry,
my daughter's name.
Okay.
Well, a quick background on it, Joe. Myself and my wife Margaret, we adopted Katie from Vietnam nearly 18 years ago. When we brought her home, we discovered that she had a disability, muscular dystrophy.
Okay.
And of course, look, you know, being adopted and Asian and having a disability, you know, she's had a lot of challenges in her life. So, but she's a very independent young woman, and she wanted to continue that independence into her adult life. She just completed her leaving certificate. So we applied for the primary medical certificate to enable Katie to get a vehicle adapted for her as a passenger, and in for future, you know, further down the line to be a driver, to enable her to get a vehicle adapted for her needs.
Yeah.
And she was turned down for a job. Now, look, on the basic level, the criteria states you have to be permanently and severely disabled. And Katie has muscular dystrophy, which is a permanent and severe disability.
Yeah.
And what I discovered, you know, when we looked at the letter from the HSE, you know, with the criteria, it seemed a very narrow definition that we're operating on. So I dug a little bit further, and I emailed the Department of Health. I emailed the Department for Children, the Department with the responsibility for disabilities, and I got a reply from the Office of the Minister of Finance, outlining, you know, the criteria and the independent role of HSE, which we would all accept, of course. But what shocked me was that the criteria was adopted in the 1960s. Yeah. So we're using criteria that was first introduced in the 1960s. Now, we've advanced as a society, obviously, but to be using criteria that's 60 years old, when our understanding of physical disability has changed immeasurably in that time, seems at best strange, but certainly at worst, it narrows the criteria for so many people in terms of getting the grant for the disabled driver's
grant. And what you're referring to, Pat, just to help people, what you're referring to is this document from the Department of Finance to qualify for a primary medical certificate, which has to be issued by a senior area medical officer, to qualify for a primary medical applicant certificate. An applicant must be permanently and severely disabled. And I take on board the language, that, and thank you for raising it, Pat, because it provides a warning as I proceed. I'm reading from this document, Pat, and it says, at least one There are six medical criteria, at least one of which is required to be satisfied in order to obtain a primary medical certificate. By the way, this is just to get some financial help with adapting your car, and you get an exemption from motor tax, big deal, and you get relief, some relief from VR, all government taxes, by the way. But anyway, these are the criteria, the six of them. And you say, Pat, you believed in 1960s. Be holy or almost holy without the use of both legs. Be holy without the use of one of their legs, and almost holy without the use of the other leg, such that they are severely restricted as to the movement of their lower limbs. Three, be without both hands or without both arms. Four, be without one or both legs. Five, be holy or almost holy without the use of both hands or arms, and holy or almost holy without the use of one leg. Six, has the medical condition of dwarfism and have serious difficulties of movement of the lower limbs. These criteria are set out in primary legislation. Now, they don't mention the year or indeed the century that primary legislation, but it is. Well, what do you think of the list? Were you as gobsmacked as I was when you read that language and the way it's written, Pat?
Absolutely, of course it was, Joanne. And look, if you look at that language, you can see how outdated it is.
Yeah.
Because as medical science advances and as we discover the wider range of disabilities, but also our society has changed. And my daughter is one of many thousands of people with a physical disability who now want to live independent lives. And if you cast your mind back to the 1960s, Joe, most people with disabilities, and this isn't a criticism, of course, but most people with disabilities were pretty much locked up in their homes.
Yeah,
we lived in a society that actually shielded society from people who were different. And thankfully, we moved on from that. But we're still using that absolutely narrow criteria. So my daughter wants to live an independent life. And as a disabled female, what's interesting as well is that less than 30% of females with a physical disability actually ever have a job.
Yeah.
Now, that's shocking.
But I know.
The reason I'm saying that is, of course, is that Caitlin wants to be one of the 30% of people who leads an active, independent life, who contributes to society. And
it's a society
in that direction.
Pat, because you're the one that nailed it at the start there. This criteria were introduced in 1969. John F. Kennedy at that stage was 6 years dead, unfortunately. But he was that was 6 years after he came to Ireland, which was 60 years ago, just to try and put it in context. And this is first of all, the number of cars in the country, there wasn't a car in our household. It wasn't even a phone in the household. The number of cars in the country were much less. The number of roads in the country are not the standard that we have today. The number of types of car that are available and the ease of driving or the easement of driving has improved dramatically in those 54 years. The world has changed. And by the way, the amount of money that the state takes from the family motorist multiples, many, many, many multiples of what they got from the motorists in 1969. So you think they couldn't look into their, I was going to say their coffers, look into their, I should have said into the coffers and say, yes, given the amount of money we take in on petrol, VRT, the highest in all of Europe, or car price the highest in all of Europe, motor tax, motor insurance, surely we could look into the coffers and try and put in a generous scheme for people who have challenges in driving and to whom a car would make the world of a difference. Now, the good news is, Pat, that the scheme was closed 10 years ago, but they set up The final report of the working group was published, and this is the working group on disability inclusion. This was after 2013. The final report was published on the 24th of February. When? 2023. Well, what people... anyway.
What's interesting as well, Joe, what's also interesting is that there was, you know, with the primary medical certificate, once a decision is made regarding your eligibility for it, that there is an appeals board. But what's also interesting is this appeals board has not existed since 2019. It was only, and ironically, you mentioned the 24th of February, it was only, ironically, only reconstituted on the 24th of February of this year. But the appeals board meets in Dunleary, in the hospital in Dunleary, but the hospital is withdrawn from the scheme. So it's still not operational. Now, if a decision is made around a citizen of this state by an organ of the state, and it impacts on them negatively, my understanding is that constitutionally, you have a right to appeal. So there is no right to appeal because there is no appeals process. So my daughter has been, her constitutional rights, I suspect, have been taken from her as well.
Any state judgment, regardless of the fora or the level, it must have an appeal system built in.
Has to have.
But by the way, did you say to me earlier, 98% of appeals are rejected?
Yes, yes.
Through the
appeals process. Yeah, this is and you see, the deeper you dig into this, Joy, the more shocking it becomes. That 90%, and this is information that comes from the Office of the Minister for Finance.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, I'm not plucking the statistic out of the air.
Okay.
This is, comes from government offices. 98% of appeals are rejected.
Okay.
So that's a closed door anyhow. Sure, but even is. Not to have the democratic right to appeal a government decision that impacts on you negatively. I mean, if we brought it out on, if God forbid you were accused of murder and found guilty, and the judge said, well, you actually have no right to appeal this judgment because there's no means. How would that sound?
Yeah.
But that's in effect what's happening to people with disabilities.
Yeah. Okay.
It's a small little support. Okay. That's all it is.
Here, Pat's in Port Leisure. Mary's in Waterford, 51551. Mary, your situation, please.
Hello, Joe.
How are you, Mary?
I had polio in childhood, which left me with a disability.
Yeah.
And over the years, I had a lot of surgeries on my back, on my knees, on my hips, on my ankle. And I'm a member of the polio support group, who, can I say, have been enormous help down through the years. Every time I went to the HSE or any place like that, I was just dismissed. They advised me to go to the rehabilitation centre for assessment for a primary grant, which I did. I went up. I had to see three individuals. My appointment was for 3 o'clock. I was back on the road to Waterford at 3:15. I went in, and the first person just asked me a few questions and never raised his head from the table and just said, yeah, that's fine. Second person came in, did the same thing. Third person came in, brought me out to a room and said, walk up and down there, which I did.
Oh, my gosh.
I came back then. I told him I have medical records, I said, from a hospital where I was treated for all the injuries I had. And he turned around and he said, that's of no interest to us. 2 days later, I got a letter to say that I wasn't disabled enough to get a primary cert.
And what age were you when you contracted polio, Mary?
I was 18 months.
And polio was a scourge and still is a scourge for so many, but it was a scourge
in
this country in the 50s and 60s. So you've had it for a long time.
What people don't realise now, that it's raised its ugly head in the name of post-polio syndrome.
Okay.
Where the effects of it, the weaknesses, are all back. So my mobility is almost gone. I can no longer go out on my own.
Yeah.
I worked all my life, and now I'm just have to rely on people who are very good to me, my family, and they do anything for me. But I think it's absolutely disgraceful that the disabled people of this country have to be put through the ringer for everything. They said, like, oh, you shouldn't have an attitude of entitlement.
Yeah. Outrageous. You know, and how long was this interview for, Mary?
My interview was for 3 o'clock in the...
Yeah, and you were back in the
rehabilitation set. And I was back on the road back to Waterford at 3:15.
So 5-10 minutes?
Yep.
And you were asked to walk?
I was asked to walk up and down outside on a barrier, and I told the person, I have no problem when I'm walking in my own house or if I'm walking in a room, but I have a problem, I said, when I go outdoors, if there's uneven surfaces. I said, I could fall for no reason.
You don't need a car to drive from your hall door to your front gate. You need a car to get you a distance. That's why people have cars.
Yeah.
And she asked, or he or she, I don't, I'm not part of it. She or she asked you to walk a few paces. Is that correct?
Yeah.
A few paces.
Yes.
And they said, on the basis of those few paces, in that short spaces, in about 5 minutes, 300 seconds, they said to you, thanks, but no thanks. You contracted polio, and polio was in this country because of the condition, the state of the country, like TB, the poverty in the country. You contracted polio when you're 18 months of age. You're now obviously much older, and you're not entitled. You're not entitled to a brass farthing to help you with a mobility issue.
They told me I'm not even entitled to a disability allowance. Going back a few years. Issuing the same thing, I'm not disabled enough. It took me 5 years to get a medical card.
Oh,
and I have to say, only for the post-polio support group.
Brilliant.
I would have left it there.
Okay, Mary, stay with us, Mary. You and I see other callers are going to take over this programme, I hope, to the end and beyond, because this is a horrific situation. Joe at RT.ie.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Who was I reading there over the weekend, which I thought was a brilliant line? I think it was a brilliant headline. Ireland is the only country in the world at the moment that's embarrassed, because we're doing so well, embarrassed to publish our financial figures in terms of income, etc. Embarrassed because we're doing so well. And now we're hearing from people looking for a modest grant. They have a disability, challenges, a modest grant towards a car to get them from A to B. Where is Una McDermott? Una.
Hello, Joe. How are you?
Your point, please.
Yeah, I am the parent, Joe, of a 20-year-old young adult with an intellectual disability, so I'm taking it sort of back out on a tangent here. I made an inquiry a couple of years ago when it dawned on me that, like, my child will not ever travel independently by car.
Okay.
She'll never be able to drive simply because she will never pass a theory test. She's a great person. She can communicate, but she'll never communicate well enough to pass the test. We are not allowed, even though we will drive her everywhere for the rest of our natural lives, we are not allowed access to the disabled driver scheme. We will not be able to get any kind of rebate on tax. We won't be able to apply for a car, allowance, buying a new car or used car. We can't get any fuel allowance, anything like that.
Yeah.
And I mean, I can't be the only parent of or relative looking at supporting someone with an intellectual disability in this situation. And our expenses are far higher than the mainstream population.
Yeah, and there was. Am I correct in saying, Una, under the scheme which was quietly put to sleep 10 years ago, There was eligibility for this relatives of somebody with a disability to help them with a car.
That, my understanding is that still stands, Joe. But okay. The problem is with, as we went through with the previous caller, the criteria for being eligible for the scheme was the loss of limbs or sight impairment, stuff like that. So it's all based on physical disability, but nobody seems to be taking into account the fact that intellectual disability also sort of disbars you from being able to drive independently. So my question is why in God's name, when it's so perfectly obvious that these relatives will not be able to drive independently, are they not included in the scheme?
Okay, very good. Very, very, very good point. And in the context of overall, it's an extraordinarily modest amount of money. By the way, does anyone remember, wasn't Ellen Keane, our Paralympic gold winner, wasn't she refused the primary medical cert to help her with a car?
I wouldn't be able to comment on that. I
think it's true. In fact, I know it's true from my memory. And I wouldn't be surprised. Given what we've heard here already today. Una, stay with us back after this break. Yeah.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And Louise, very popular name on the programme today. Louise, you make this point and make it very strongly because it's very true. Go ahead, Louise.
Yes, Joe. My husband, he's got Parkinson's. He was refused twice. We applied for it twice. And once again, like one of your previous callers, there is no appeal really because there isn't a board set up that you get a letter back saying, you can appeal, but at the moment we have to set a board up or words to that effect anyway. But, they're not free. These cars aren't free.
Yes,
we're paying for them.
Everyone
is saying, because when I did look into it, I said, could you get a second-hand one? I wouldn't really want a new one, thinking it would be, but everyone is sort of saying, there's no point because you won't get your VAT back or... it's just a point I want to make. We're not getting them free. You actually get them free in the UK.
You have to buy a new car and you have to, it's exempt from the penal government taxes, which,
But you're looking at maybe 300 or 400 euros a month as a payment. Do you know what I'm saying? They're not giving us anything free. We're paying for it. Do you know? In the UK, you get the disabled cars or, I don't know what it's called in the UK, but you get them free.
Oh, dear, I didn't know that. Yeah. And then your husband, why would, insofar as you want to tell me, Louise, why would your husband refused?
He wasn't disabled enough, I presume.
Okay.
He went in, he had to walk for, he has it 10 years. He has it 10 years. So it speaks for itself.
But I'm going back, and I'll include your husband in this, if I may. And I'm going back to Eve Noonan's position, looking for help for someone who's driving somebody who's disabled, but intellectually disabled. But I'm going back to Mary, and indeed your own husband. What do these people who make these decisions think? Do they think Mary is deliberately exaggerating her injury? Still wasn't enough.
He went in. He uses a stick now and again. Do you know what I mean? He uses a stick to help him around. He tries not. He's great around the house and everything. But at the end of the day, when we're out, he just wanted a little bit of, help. Really, that's all.
Yeah.
Help. And like I say, we will. We're willing to pay for it. It's not free.
It's an exemption from the taxes. Okay.
And like your previous caller, there is no appeal. It says you can appeal, but
this is a government that is embarrassed now by the amount of tax that are taken in. 2 billion more than they even predicted, even though the predictions went up. Okay, good morning, Margaret, Louise, Una, Mary and Pat Rowe. And Pat, kind regards to Katie Lynn. Joe at RT.ie continues. Kieran Cullen on sound, BCO, Shane Galvin, producer Nadine Maloney, and Ray Darcy is next.
0818 715 815 stays open until 3:15 p.m. or email joe@rte.ie.